BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
...2024 is the year of elections. According to one estimate, just under 50% of all the people on Earth live in countries where by December the 31st there will have been a national vote. To mark this phenomenon, we've made three special podcasts. In this one, we're focusing on what we might call sham democracies, countries whose governments hold elections the opposition are not allowed to win. But why do dictators bother holding elections if the outcomes are predetermined? And for the same reason, why do their publics bother voting in them? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. In the first half of this programme, we're going to look at two countries where elections are anything but free and fair. We'll start with Bangladesh, where an election was held in January. What happened? Naomi Hussain is Professor of Development Studies at SOAS. Naomi Hussain, what's the size of the population and the electorate in Bangladesh?
Well, we've got 170 million people in Bangladesh. You know, it's the eighth biggest country in the world by population. I don't think people know that. And I actually don't know the precise numbers of the size of the electorate, but as you can imagine, it's huge. You're quite a young population. And so it's a vast potential electorate, shall we say.
Now, could you give us a quick overview of what took place in the elections, which I gather happened in January? Who won?
So, I mean, to call it even an election, really, David, is a bit of a stretch. You know, the outcome was widely seen as pretty well known in advance of what happened. And eventually the ruling party, the Awami League, who've been in power for now 15 years, won or declared victory, declared that there had been a 40% turnout, although from what I hear here in Dhaka, about 20% is a bit more likely. And the only people really who have taken seats in parliament apart from the ruling party are, I think it's 62, perhaps, people who stood as independents, but who are believed to be, in fact, members of the ruling party as well, standing as proxies. And this is largely to do with the fact that the main opposition party, the BNP, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, boycotted the elections, as they have tended to do in the last few elections, on the grounds that they couldn't possibly be free and fair.
Right, we'll come into the question of how they're not free and fair in a moment. Can you just remind us about the leader of the Awami League and the person, therefore, who leads the country?
So the Prime Minister is Sheikh Hasina. And Sheikh Hasina has been in power, as I say, since 2009. And previously, she also was Prime Minister in 96 to 2001. And she is also the daughter of the founding father of the nation, as we call him, Bangabandhu, which means friend of the Bengalis. Bangabandhu Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, and he and his wife and several of his children and other people in their family were murdered in 1975, a really horrendous bloody murder. And that has really shaped our politics, as has other assassinations since then. But Sheikh Hasina, of course, this is, you know, for her both personally and politically, an important part of her political history, of her political brand. Her father was the leader, really, of the party, of the movement that brought Bangladesh to independence back in 1971.
So how has Bangladesh changed in the 50-odd years since then?
Bangladesh, when it was born, it was known, as Henry Kissinger called it, the basket case, the world's basket case. You know, it was very poor. We were facing famine, mass public health crises. It was a devastated place. And so really the last 50 years, the last 52 years of Bangladesh have been very much about catching up developmentally. And Bangladesh has been remarkably successful.
Well, that's very interesting, because I want to come on in a moment to you explaining exactly how the election gets to be rigged and how that's managed. But I suppose the question is, when you have a success story like that, and obviously the population would tend to recognise it, why do you need to rig the elections? Because wouldn't you win them anyway?
But then the food price crisis, energy price crisis, has really changed all of that. So the last few years, people are really struggling, and that's beginning to show. I think that given that the opposition party, the BNP party, although people, I think, on the whole, would really prefer to have a change of government after 15 years, and the Bangladesh people are very well known for their anti-incumbency, which means that if you're in power, next election you most likely won't be. If they get to vote you out, they will. And that's what our experience has been. But even then, you know, the BNP just does not seem to have an effective program, a manifesto that's convinced very many people, apart from the fact that it's their turn to rule.
Now let's get down to the nitty-gritty. How does the Bangladeshi government go about rigging the elections? Does it actually miscount the vote? Does it just prevent anybody effectively from standing against them? How does it do it?
Essentially, the opposition party has been very, very weakened by its last 15 years in opposition. And previously to that, when we had an army-backed caretaker government for 2 years, who jailed the BNP leadership for various reasons. Many of them were put in jail after a big rally at the end of October, when there was violence. Thousands, I think, have been injured in the political violence in the run-up to this election. The election happened on January the 7th. If you started looking at Bangladesh in November or December and you said, oh, it doesn't look like they're going to have a free and fair election, you'd be like, well, no, of course they're not, because there isn't really a proper opposition in place.
Now, I mean, what about the media? I mean, is that a factor? Does the government effectively control the media at the time of election?
It tries very hard. You know, the media, I feel really, they're quite courageous people, because there have been really, really strong efforts to control the media, to silence the media, to close various media houses down, silence newspaper editors. I know several newspaper editors also have around 100 legal cases against them. Harassment through the law is very common here, sort of common political strategy against your opponents. But they're not, I wouldn't say they were entirely captured at all. No, you can. And sometimes you have to read between the lines, but the press does a good job. There's some exile media, there's some external media. The international media has taken somewhat more interest in what goes on in Bangladesh in recent years. And so certain stories have come out about various aspects of, you know, political violence and corruption and so on in recent years. So that also helps.
There's a feeling that the support for democracy is eroding and the desire for the strong leadership has been growing throughout the world. Is that the case in Bangladesh? In other words, do the Bangladeshi people think that that is a trade-off that they want to have, or is it simply one that's enforced upon them?
I think the latter, I think enforced. I don't think Bangladeshis have a strong desire for strong man, or in our case, strong woman rule in particular. I think it's great, you know, if you're a country where you're prone to a lot of disasters and so on, it's great that you have a government that feels capable of getting things done. But I have seen this in my own research over the years, is that, you know, whenever there's an economic crisis, whenever there's a rice price crisis, you know, when the price of food goes up in particular, people start saying things like, well, it's because we don't have an elected government. If we had an elected government, people would be listening to us and the price of rice would come down. And I saw this back in the last global food crisis in 2008, 2009. And I think we're hearing something similar now.
Naomi Hossain. So that's one sham election that's already happened. And there's another big one that's taking place this month, where they'll be voting in Russia. Joining me in the briefing room now is Katerina Totichnaya, Associate Professor in Comparative Politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Oxford. Katerina Totichnaya, can you just remind us when the elections in Russia are going to be, what it is people are electing and who it is they're electing, who's on the ballot, and maybe also tell us how many people are actually eligible to vote?
So the presidential election in Russia will be held on the 15th, 16th and 17th of March, and it will take place over two rounds if a single candidate does not receive more than half the vote. However, this is unlikely. And according to all predictions, Vladimir Putin, the current president, is to win from the first round of the election.
Can we just talk a little bit more about the opponents that Vladimir Putin faces? In what way are they vetted?
Interested parties need to submit a number of signatures in support of their candidacy, and those signatures need to be later approved. It is often the case that the Electoral Commission will cite irregularities with the collection of signatures, or that they will propose that there are repeated signatures, or that they are unable to verify signatory parties. And this will be used as a legal excuse not to allow opposition candidates to compete in the election.
Can you just tell me whether or not the opposition, such as it is, has any equal access or any significant access to media outlets in order to put its point of view to the electorate?
Yes, so media access and the ability to campaign is an important criterion we usually look at in the period leading up to the election in order to determine whether everybody's views are represented fairly and equally. Some opposition parties, especially those we call the systemic opposition, so opposition parties represented in the state Duma, so in the Russian parliaments, they will be sometimes afforded access to national media. Their views will be heard. Parties such as the communists also maintain a very active website, if you like, where they post their views and opinions. But the coverage they're afforded is nowhere comparable to the one that the incumbent receives, of course. You know, the views and opinions of non-systemic opposition parties and groups, those not represented in the State Duma, are further marginalized.
By systemic opposition, do you mean by that the opposition which is tolerated by the government?
Exactly. So the opposition that is tolerated by the government and also the opposition that is loyal to the government. There is this implicit agreement that there is, as you say, mutual toleration and mutual support, especially at politically sensitive times, at times of large anti-regime protests. And we've seen some of those taking place in 2011, 2012 in Russia. Systemic opposition parties will express their loyalties. The systemic opposition will also express support to the government when it comes to important votes in parliament. And indeed, when it comes to important questions, the Communist Party, for instance, organized foreign invasion protests all across last summer and the year before in order to express its support to the authorities.
What about the Russian people themselves, as far as we can tell? Do they believe and vote in the knowledge that actually the results are a foregone conclusion?
Some of the reasons people cite as to why they would participate in elections before they do or why they participated are not that different, really, from the reasons cited in democracies. So, for example, people will say, I vote because this is my civic duty. I'm fulfilling my obligations as a citizen of the country. Or I appreciate the choice that I am being given. I don't want my votes to be used without my knowledge or my consent, for example. Or it is pleasant. People accrue positive utility by participating in elections, even in authoritarian contexts.
That suggests that in Russia, at any rate, that what we might call a sham election actually works.
To the extent that elections and democratic institutions are adopted in authoritarian regimes in order to bolster perceptions of regime legitimacy and give people the stake or the ability to participate, yes, this is an aim they have been achieving over the years.
So, Katerina, if we already know the result, what should we be looking out for in this election?
The first of them will be, what is the actual share of eligible Russians that turn out to vote? Participation in the election will provide a strong signal of whether people still think that institutional politics is meaningful in the election or not. And likewise, whether the Kremlin has been able to mobilize people in the way it has been doing in the past. Another interesting question, of course, is the share of votes that the president will receive and the extent to which the authorities will feel compelled to engage in electoral fraud or falsification. We have known in the past that the Kremlin has asked for a 70-70 formula, meaning very high turnout. And of those people who turn out, 70% of them putting the Russian authorities, the incumbent president, first. It will be interesting to see whether this formula, the 70-70 formula, is achieved and what the Kremlin's reaction to these numbers will be.
Katerina Tatichnaya, Russia and Bangladesh, two specific examples. But let's now broaden this out to look at the question of who's winning out in the world, the sham electioneers or the genuine Democrats. With me are Ben Ansell, Professor of Comparative Democratic Institutions at Nuffield College, University of Oxford, and the most recent Reith lecturer, and Erica France, Associate Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University. Ben Ansell, this programme is about at what we call sham democracy. And we've looked at two examples, Bangladesh and Russia. Can we broaden it out a bit and look at just how widespread what we might call sham democracy actually is?
Yeah, thanks, David. It's about a third of all countries have a regime that we would, in political science, we would call electoral authoritarian. So it's a country where the elections aren't free or fair, but they still happen nonetheless. And in some ways, that's quite a new phenomenon, you know, having everybody troop out to the polls in a universal suffrage, but your vote doesn't matter. In another way, we've been doing this for a century and a half, because about consistently 35 to 40% of countries since the 19th century have been undemocratic, but had elections of some kind. And we were one of them in the United Kingdom up until 1918. So it's not entirely new, but the way in which it sort of looks more like our kind of democratic elections, that's new.
Can you give a couple of other examples? So, I mean, obviously we've gone through Bangladesh and Russia, but what are the other big examples of long-lived electorally authoritarian regimes?
Well, some of them don't exist anymore, but certainly had elections up until recently and aren't perfect democracies. Mexico is a great example. There'll be an election this year to replace the incumbent. It's very likely that his handpicked successor will win. But it's not that the election isn't completely unfair or rigged. It's rather that, as is true in many borderline democracies, there's ways in which the incumbent party makes life easier for themselves, both through policies and through controls on the media. But if we were talking about the 80s or 70s in Mexico, that was a country where there was only one party, the PRI, that ever won elections, but there were still elections.
Right. Erica, those countries governed by dictators, authoritarians, why do they bother with the elections if the result is predetermined?
It's actually kind of fascinating because it does seem like a puzzle, but there's a large body of research that shows that the dictatorships that have these elections on a regular basis with multiple parties last longer in office than those that don't. So there's really good survival reasons for authoritarian regimes to hold these contests.
Why do we think that is? I mean, what about these elections actually helps them?
There's some debates about the mechanisms that explain why. But from the perspective of elites, it helps the leadership group show to other elites who might want that position that it's strong if it can get a lot of people to mobilize in support of the regime. And then from the perspective of citizens, it's an opportunity for the regime to give them perks. So there's evidence from Egypt, for example, that under Mubarak, that prior to elections, calorie consumption was higher among ordinary citizens. So there's a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes that accumulates to the situation that helps these regimes.
Okay, that has just blown me away, I will admit. And it kind of leads me on to my next question, Ben, but both of you can tackle it. Is there what you might like to call a modern authoritarian's election playbook?
Yeah, I think that's right. So you can think of doing kind of hard election blocking stuff like imprisoning opponents, and that clearly has happened, even in a country that we wouldn't think of as a full dictatorship like Pakistan, right? Imran Khan was jailed just before the election in February of this year. In Turkey, that happened with İmamoğlu being given criminal charges before the Turkish election. So that's quite common, but that's pretty blunt, right? Banning other parties or imprisoning their leaders. The sneaky way of doing this will be to engage in media restrictions, turning off the internet before polling because you're worried that citizens are figuring out that you're trying to rig the election. So there's a wide array of different parts of the toolkit. And that, in a way, is what makes it so hard for Western observers or democratic observers to know exactly what's going on in each of these countries, because it's not just people piling votes into the back of vans anymore.
Erica, can you take us through for some of the other parts of what Ben just called the toolkit?
Yeah, I agree. There's definitely a toolkit that is more savvy, where authoritarian regimes are trying to be as subtle in their tactics as possible. So from Hungary, for example, Orban and his Fidesz group.
He's the prime minister there.
Yeah. And they've changed the electoral rules to help benefit the party. So they're doing things that are disadvantaging their opponents that aren't that obvious to the casual observer.
What kind of thing, Erica?
So for one, changing the electoral rules so that their party's going to for sure get a majority in their districts. They also have, as Ben mentioned, these advantages in their campaigning, where they have access to the media and might disadvantage the opposition from getting access. In Singapore, they are very savvy as well, where they will sue their opponents for libel and then bankrupt them so that they no longer have much of a resources for a campaign. And all of this is to try to get away from the accusations that they're just stealing votes.
Right. And also to get away from the position whereby you actually just have to fake the results.
Right. Because the big risk there that the all authoritarians want to avoid is that there might be some protest. And fraudulent elections can be really this triggering event that can mobilize people to hit the streets to oppose the regime.
Right. OK. So we have this toolkit, this playbook for doing it. Now let's look at it from the other point of view, which is from the people's point of view. Why do, Erica, people turn out in sham elections?
So, you know, we have to look at both the perspective of opponents of the regime and supporters. For supporters, they turn out a lot of times because they're getting certain perks from doing so. I mentioned calorie consumption in Egypt, but under Mexico, it might have been things like T-shirts distributed, or you might be threatened if you're part of a union or something that your job might be at risk if you don't turn out. So they're doing it because they think that they have benefits from supporting the regime. For opponents, it's a lot more complicated because the decision over whether to turn out can actually split the opposition, which is what the regime wants, because they don't want to legitimize it. But on the other hand, if they don't actually turn out to vote, then their voices aren't heard. So it's very complicated. It's a complicated calculation for the opposition.
Ben, that seems to me to be a very real dilemma if you're in opposition.
Absolutely. It's a huge coordination problem. So we saw in Bangladesh, which you've talked about on the show, that the main opposition party withdrew entirely, which meant that the incumbents won, you know, a huge lion's share of the vote. And what did the opposition get for that? Well, not very much. But coordinating is really hard. So what Navalny was doing, what he was asking Russians to do before he was, what appears to be murdered, was he was asking people to show up to the polls at noon. The idea was that Putin couldn't stop people from voting at noon. He couldn't close the polling booths for an hour. And so that would be something you could coordinate on to show this mass discontent. But think about how hard it is to construct a message like that, to get people to acknowledge, oh, there's a lot more opposition than I thought there was because people are showing up at noon. You might be the old lady who loves Vladimir Putin and you've shown up at noon and now you're surrounded by a bunch of Putin opponents.
Erica, we heard from Katerina Tatichnaya that actually quite a lot of Russians turn up because they still believe it's their civic duty to vote, even if the election is rigged.
I think that context is a little bit unique just because of the, you know, history of the Soviet Union and the ways in which, even though they only had like one person on the ballot, they would still be encouraged to turn out to vote. So that might be one component. But it's also very difficult from the outside perspective to really get into the minds of voters. You know, we know that Putin has a lot of popularity compared to many other autocrats, despite what we might expect. And so it's perhaps possible that people are voting out because they genuinely like, or turning out to vote because they genuinely support him.
Ben, we're familiar with the phrase that hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So I'm wondering whether the places which hold sham elections ever transition to proper elections simply because for years they've been saying we've got proper elections.
I mean, it can happen by accident. And certainly there are a number of leaders of authoritarian countries who got themselves elected out of office. That famously happened to Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia in the early 1990s. He had tried to have referendums to keep himself in power, to give up, had to have multi-party elections and lost. And then he was done. So that can happen. But Mexico, I think, is a good example of a country that was a one-party state, essentially, and then did slowly liberalise during the 1990s, imperfectly, but I think quite stably. So it's not impossible to have this kind of peaceful transition that happens when elections that didn't matter start to matter. But what you can't expect is that the Mexican elections that happen after the end of the PRI are going to be fully free and fair because there's such a legacy of distrust.
Does that happen because the ruling party essentially loses the will to live, or because it splits and doesn't have a kind of a unified strategic objective anymore?
I mean, it really commonly happens during economic crises. And those are always very challenging for these electoral authoritarian regimes. And waves of democratic transitions, research shows they tend to happen to countries that were already quite embedded in security or trade relationships with democracy. Certainly that was true for Mexico at the time. And so they may feel compelled by the democracies that are around them to move in that direction. But generally, there's going to be a trigger moment, and it's usually an economic crisis.
Erica, what's your observation on this?
So, yeah, I agree with most of this. And, you know, it's very tricky as observers because particularly groups that are engaged in democracy promotion, you want to see these multi-party elections in authoritarian contexts as some sort of signal that liberalization is on the horizon. Well, in some instances, like Ben mentioned, it does happen and the regime surprisingly leaves power and it's peaceful and you see democracy. But as I was discussing earlier, we know that these contests are associated with longer authoritarian survival. So on the one hand, it might be this surprise event that in some cases can generate positive change. But in many instances, it is an indicator of a savvy authoritarian regime that is prolonging its rule.
Ben, can you take us through what it is the research tells us about the state of democracy in the world and people's attitude towards it right now?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of distrust in government generally, in distrust in incumbent parties in Western countries. I mean, it's very hard to find any country where the incumbent leader has extremely high approval ratings throughout the West. Some of that is likely just the legacy of pretty systemically bad economic growth since the Great Recession across most countries. And even in those countries where there is growth, like the United States, it doesn't seem to be helping the incumbent parties. So I think some of it might be time limited, but I think there is a broader democratic malaise. And it might be in part because we have seen a slowdown, a stopping, maybe even a retreat in democracy worldwide, which, you know, once the momentum stops or once the shark stops swimming, it becomes hard for everybody to think that this is inevitable. And then there's a questioning in democracies of how well the democracies are working themselves. So you can think about it, democracy being on the offensive, as it was in the 80s and 90s, and democracy being on the defensive, as it is now, particularly because authoritarian countries have been so aggressive in intervening in democratic elections.
Erica, the Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Ressa recently said, "We will know whether democracy lives or dies by the end of 2024. It's a ringing phrase. Do you think it's true?
Well, I mean, it's a bold statement. I do think, you know, speaking about countries like the United States that have historically played kind of a large role in democracy promotion and support, what happens in the 2024 election in the U.S. is going to be fairly consequential globally. And we saw it under the first Trump administration, where there was a rollback of a number of policies that traditionally had been more supportive of global democracy. So if we do see a second Trump term, I do think it's going to have large scale repercussions that would be harmful for global democracy.
Ben.
Yeah, I think the way I always answer the question, is Trump the end of American democracy, is to say, no, that's unlikely, but he might be the end for democracy in other countries who the Americans have committed to supporting. In other words, what matters about the US election is the implications for American foreign policy and whether countries like Taiwan or Estonia that are threatened by authoritarian countries can survive. So I think that's the real way in which democracy could collapse, is when the one remaining superpower decides it's no longer interested in the global democracy business.
Ben Ansell there with Erica France. My thanks to them, Katerina Totichnaya and Naomi Hossein. Just before we go, a reminder that you can listen to the other election specials and hundreds of other episodes on a myriad of different topics by visiting BBC Sounds. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Ellie House and Ajay Singh. The editor was Richard Varden and the studio engineer was James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Forgive us, listeners, for we have sinned.
And we want to know why.
I'm Becky Ripley.
And I'm Sophie Ward.
And we're here to tell you about our new podcast series,
Seven Deadly Psychologies.
Now available on Seriously from BBC Radio 4.
So, ready?
Born ready. Where we take a cold, hard look at the psychology behind each of the seven deadly sins.
We shouldn't discard them. We should ask ourselves what they mean.
It's this idea that if you give in to your lusts, that you are animal-like.
We have to let our minds have time to freewheel.
Finding empathy is probably the best tool to manage anger.
To hear the whole series, just search Seven Deadly Psychologies on BBC Sounds.